Consider for a moment the nature of medicine as we understand it in the modern world.
Right, our modern framework.
Yeah. We expect a clinical, highly precise intervention. You know, a laser dissolving a cataract in a matter of seconds.
Or a synthesized molecule targeting a very specific enzyme in the bloodstream.
Exactly. Our relationship to healing is inherently sanitized. We want the diagnosis to be binary, the treatment to be painless, and, well, the recovery to be basically invaluable.
We want to be handed a neatly packaged cure.
Right. You take it and you move on with your life, completely untouched by the profound existential weight of the illness itself.
Because we demand that our healing leaves our worldview completely intact. We don't want to be changed. We just want to be fixed.
Yes. Beautifully put. But the ancient pharmacopoeia of the spiritual path, it operates under a vastly different paradigm.
Vastly different.
When you step into the diagnostic landscape of early Buddhist contemplation, that pristine, brightly lit clinic just vanishes.
It's gone.
You find yourself in a space that is murky, deeply challenging, and frankly, profoundly uncomfortable.
And that discomfort is entirely intentional.
Right. The medicine administered here doesn't merely target a symptom. It forces the practitioner to look directly at the most visceral, often grotesque realities of human existence.
The discomfort is not a side effect. The discomfort is the active ingredient.
It is the active ingredient. Yeah. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we are opening a profoundly fascinating and historically challenging sutra from the Tibetan Buddhist canon.
Yes, a really remarkable text.
It's known as the Deceptions of Dharma, an antidote to desire. Or, in its Tibetan translation, Phags Pachoski Fungpo Sis Bayabateg Bateg Pachengguardo.
Beautiful title for a heavy text.
Truly. And before we step into the architecture of this teaching, we really must acknowledge the extraordinary scholars and translators at the 84,000 Project.
Translating the words of the Buddha.
Yes. Their monumental effort to bring this canonical text into English is the sole reason we are able to sit with these ancient words today.
It's a profound gift to anyone walking the path of study. Translating a text of this density is not, as you know, it's not merely an act of linguistic conversion.
No, not at all.
It's an act of conceptual preservation. The mission of our analysis today is to carefully walk you through a sutra that presents a striking, almost jarring juxtaposition.
Jarring is the right word.
Because on one hand, it delivers the soaring, absolute philosophical view of emptiness characteristic of the Mahayana tradition.
Right.
But on the other hand, it plunges the reader into the gritty, highly intense ascetic body contemplations of early monasticism.
Which means it demands a specific kind of listening from you today. As we explore the ancient roots of human desire and, well, the visceral methods used by early ascetics to sever it, we invite you to settle in.
Settle in and open your mind.
Listen not merely as an academic observing an artifact behind glass, but as a practitioner. Allow the deliberate pace of these teachings to create a space in your mind.
Let the weight of the philosophy settle before we move forward.
Exactly. So to truly absorb the weight of these words, we first need to understand the vessel that carried them through time.
Because the lineage of a text grounds its authority.
It does. And the sections of Dharma entered the snowy ranges of Tibet during the imperial period.
A true golden age of translation.
Right, spanning roughly the 7th to the 9th century of the Common Era. And it was translated into Tibetan by the prolific translator Yeshe Day.
Working in profound collaboration with the Indian preceptor Prajan Bardhaman.
And the physical and intellectual undertaking of that era, I mean, it's staggering to consider.
It really is. They weren't working in comfortable modern university libraries.
No, they were operating in the massive translation bureaus of early monasteries like Samye, taking incredibly dense Sanskrit concepts and meticulously forging a new Tibetan philosophical vocabulary just to hold them.
And the timeline of their work isn't a matter of guesswork. The presence of this specific sutra is firmly anchored in history by the earliest Tibetan imperial catalogs,
which is so crucial for historical context.
We find it recorded in both the Dhenkarma and the Fangfengma catalogs. These are massive imperial inventories that date to no later than 824 CE.
So we have this definitive historical bedrock.
We do. But the lineage also holds a really compelling mystery.
The lost original.
Exactly. Despite its unquestionable antiquity and its revered status in the Tibetan canon, no Sanskrit version of this text survives in the world today.
It was completely lost to the Indian subcontinent.
Completely. The teachings survive only in this Tibetan translation and a subsequent Mongolian translation derived from the Tibetan.
And there are no known commentaries either, right?
None. What you are engaging with today is a standalone, isolated survival of early Mahayana ascetic thought.
That isolation, it gives the text a certain raw authority.
It really does.
And the setting of the sutra itself establishes a scene of immense gravity. The narrative transports us to Kapilavastu, the ancient home of the Buddha.
Specifically to the Nyingrodha Park.
Yes, the Nyingrodha Park. The Blessed One is dwelling there, surrounded by a great saga of 500 monks. And it's not just a general assembly.
No, the heaviest intellects and most realized practitioners of the early community arrive.
We're talking about Venerables Shariputra, Mahamudra Galyana, Mahakajapa, Ananda, and Rahula.
They approach the Buddha, they prostrate, place their heads at his feet, and take their seats.
And the presence of these specific figures, particularly Shariputra, signals to the reader that a profound dialectic is about to occur.
Right, because Shariputra is traditionally regarded as the foremost of the disciples in analytical wisdom.
So when he steps forward to ask the inciting question, he is essentially speaking on behalf of the analytical categorizing mind.
He is. He asks the Buddha to clarify a specific term. He says, "Blessed One, you have spoken of sections of the Dharma, but what is the extent of those sections of the Dharma to which the Thus Gone One refers using that expression?"
How many such sections are there? And the Buddha's immediate response is numerical. He states that there are 84,000 sections of the Dharma.
Which is a very specific traditional number.
It is. For anyone listening who might not be familiar with the technical usage of that phrase, a Dharma discourse or Dharmapariya, is not simply a chapter in a textbook.
Right. It's not just a lesson.
It is a highly specific, targeted, therapeutic intervention. Buddhist psychology traditionally asserts that sentient beings are afflicted by 84,000 distinct emotional and cognitive obscurations.
So therefore, the master physician provides 84,000 specific medicines.
Exactly. But the precision of Shariputra's question is fascinating because he's essentially asking for the master catalog.
He's looking for the administrative breakdown of the path.
Yeah, a neat, comprehensive list of rules, practices, and categorizations.
He wants the architecture of the Dharma mapped out.
But the Buddha recognizes that providing a mere list would only feed the conceptualizing mind.
It would just be more food for intellect.
Right, so instead of handing Shariputra a spreadsheet of practices, the Buddha delivers a profound philosophical shock. He pulls the rug out entirely.
He bypasses the request for categorization and immediately strikes at the root of reality itself.
He tells Shariputra that the birthlessness of all phenomena is the primary sense of a section of the Dharma.
That single word, birthlessness, it situates the entire sutra within the profound depths of the Mahayana framework.
Specifically, the teachings of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma.
Yes. The Buddha goes on to make an uncompromising declaration. He states, "I do not claim that there is something called phenomena, or that anything whatsoever is born or ceases."
He asserts that all phenomena are, at their very core, unborn and unceasing.
Unborn and unceasing.
To truly grasp the magnitude of claiming that nothing is born, we have to break down how we normally experience the world.
We have to look at the mechanics of delusion.
Right. The Buddha explains that ordinary beings are blind because they conceptualize what are known as the aggregates.
The Tibetan term is fungpo.
Fungpo. This is the fundamental mechanism of human delusion. So let's define that for a moment.
The five aggregates form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. They are the building blocks of our perceived reality.
But in Buddhist psychology, these aren't solid entities.
No, they are five shifting, impermanent, deeply interconnected processes.
So we experience a physical form. We feel a fleeting sensation of pleasure or pain. We perceive and categorize a visual object. We generate a mental formation or an impulse toward that object, and a moment of consciousness arises.
And the tragedy of the ordinary mind is that it takes these five ephemeral heaps, stitches them together through the power of habit, and solidifies them into an independent, lasting entity.
We say, this is a beautiful object, or this is me.
Exactly. And the sutra is utterly unflinching about the danger of this cognitive habit.
The Buddha says childish, ordinary beings are blind and thus conceptualize the form aggregate.
But conceptualizing is bondage. Not to form concepts is to be liberated.
The act of freezing an impermanent, unborn process into a solid concept is the very definition of being trapped.
Which really forces us to ask a structural question about the sutra itself.
Why begin here?
Right. Why begin a text that is explicitly designed to combat the visceral, bodily agony of sexual desire with the highest, most abstract philosophical truth of emptiness?
If the text is an antidote to desire, starting with the ontological status of reality seems, at first glance, incredibly theoretical.
It seems like a detour.
Yeah, but the logic is actually a perfectly closed loop. If phenomena do not truly arise or cease, if the physical bodies and sensory experiences we intensely crave lack any independent solid core, then the object of our desire is entirely fabricated.
The sutra is not just telling you how to suppress a craving.
No, it is systematically deconstructing the object you are creating. It's proving that the intense longing you feel is directed at a mirage.
The objects we covet are imaginary projections generated by our own conceptualizing minds.
The architecture of that illusion is vital to understand.
Because when you feel a burning desire for a physical form, you are not reacting to the reality of the form itself.
You are reacting to the concept you have laid over it.
You are conceptualizing the form aggregate. And as the Buddha stated, conceptualizing is bondage.
It's much like being caught in the grip of a vivid nightmare. Think about it. Imagine you are terrified by a monster, or conversely, desperately coveting a glittering treasure in a dream.
You feel real fear or real greed.
Your heart races. But the Buddha is not stepping into the dream to hand you a sword to fight the monster.
Nor is he giving you a map to steal the treasure.
No, he is shaking you awake. He is pointing out that the dream fabric itself, the monster, the treasure, and the dream self experiencing them, was never born.
It never possessed a single atom of true existence.
The realization of that dreamlike nature is the ultimate medicine.
However, the sutra recognizes a profound difficulty on the path.
The gap between intellectual understanding and realization.
Exactly. A practitioner might understand emptiness intellectually. They might sit on the cushion and comprehend that all phenomena are unborn.
Yet when they stand up, the biological, deeply ingrained habit of the aggregates takes over.
And they still feel the agonizing physical pull of craving.
The intellectual understanding just hasn't penetrated the visceral experience of the body.
Knowing that the cognitive habit of desire is stubbornly resilient, the Buddha shifts the tone of the sutra dramatically.
Having established the absolute view of emptiness, he descends into the relative world.
He introduces a highly specific, painfully worldly analogy to illustrate the sheer suffering of being gripped by this illusory desire.
And this is where he introduces a group of individuals referred to as the Panakas and Anchas.
To navigate this analogy with the academic impartiality it requires, we really must rely closely on the translation notes provided by the 84,000 scholars.
It's important to be precise here.
These Sanskrit terms, in the context of ancient Indian literature, referred to individuals with deficient sexual faculties, neuters, eunuchs, or the sexually impotent.
And the sutra uses them to represent individuals who experience the psychological arousal of sexual passion, but are completely physically incapable of acting upon or fulfilling it.
The language the text uses to describe their internal state is startling in its physicality.
It's very intense. The Buddha paints a picture of these individuals seeing a beautiful woman. The desire is triggered, the conceptualization occurs, but the physical release is blocked.
The sutra says they suffer intense pain in their internal ducts.
Their ducts become hard like metal, their faces flush red, and their bodies are racked with tension.
The Buddha turns to Shariputra and asks why their ducts cause them such agonizing pain, pointing out that they haven't been struck by arrows or weapons.
And Shariputra's response is the crux of the entire analogy. He explains that their desirous minds make them boil with affliction.
Boil with affliction.
They are tormented by the pangs of lust from the inside out until their ducts burst and their bodies become ruined.
The violence is entirely self-generated by the conceptualizing mind.
That phrase, boil with affliction, it carries an immense psychological weight.
It does. And the sutra immediately contrasts this state of boiling torment with the sons of the Sukhya ascetic.
Referring to the ordained monks practicing Brahmacharya, or absolute pure conduct.
The text describes these monks as having realized that sense pleasures lack any true substance.
Because they see the emptiness of the object, they grow weary of the pursuit.
They pacify their thoughts, and as a result of that internal cooling, the text notes that their complexions are bright.
The juxtaposition is stark.
On one side, you have the physical and psychological devastation of unfulfilled obsessive craving.
On the other, the physical radiance and stability of a pacified mind that has dropped the conceptual burden.
Now, this analogy often requires a deeper layer of synthesis for modern listeners.
Yes, let's explore that. Because on the surface, using ancient categories of physical impotence to describe the suffering of monks might feel incredibly culturally bound.
It might even feel jarring or exclusionary.
But if we peel back the historical vocabulary, the psychological observation underneath it is universal.
The insight goes far beyond the literal constraints of the physical body. In the Mahayana view, all worldly desire is fundamentally characterized by impotence.
It is spiritually impotent.
Even if an individual possesses perfect physical faculties and unlimited access to the objects of their desire, the fundamental mechanics of craving ensure it can never be truly fulfilled.
Indulging a desire does not extinguish it.
No, it merely reinforces the habitual groove in the mind, ensuring the craving will return stronger the next time.
The itch always returns. So the burning, the agonizing tension, the boiling with affliction described in the Pataka analogy, it's not just the plight of a specific historical group.
It is the exact internal state of anyone currently caught in the trance of chasing illusions.
We surround ourselves with objects, statuses, and digital validation that we can never truly possess because they are inherently impermanent and empty.
We are left boiling with affliction over mirages.
The tension comes from demanding that an impermanent world provide permanent satisfaction.
It is an impossible demand. And the friction of that impossibility is the boiling the sutra describes.
So once a practitioner truly understands that desire is a painful trap built on illusions, the question becomes mechanical.
How do you break the illusion? How do you dismantle the machinery of attraction?
The sutra answers this by moving from philosophical deconstruction to a brutal, visceral deconstruction of sensory beauty.
The Buddha begins to systematically dismantle the physical form, starting with the eyes.
He speaks of ascetics whose discipline is wavering, who sit and fantasize about the beauty of women.
He says these ascetics cling to certain features of their eyes, perceiving them to be like beryl. They do not see them as bubbles of water.
The aesthetic romanticization of the human eye, calling it a jewel, a window to the soul, it's a deeply ingrained human habit.
But the Buddha attacks this romanticization with a jarring medicinal imagery.
He strips away the poetry. He reduces the eye to its most grotesque biological reality.
He compares the eye to the filthy placenta of a sow, a female donkey, or a wild dog.
He describes the eyes as oozing pus and blood, utterly devoid of the jewel-like qualities the afflicted mind projects onto them.
It is an extreme visualization.
But the text reveals that the eyes are disagreeable, not merely because of this biological grossness, but because of a deeper structural lie.
The biological disgust is a tool to expose a philosophical truth.
The text states explicitly that the eyes are disagreeable because they see the absence of form as form.
They see the absence of sensation as sensation.
The physical senses are portrayed as fundamentally deceitful agents.
They present a continuous, solid, vibrantly beautiful world to consciousness when in reality, they're just processing fleeting, empty stimuli.
They lead the mind into an ocean of attachment based entirely on fraudulent data.
To further illustrate the agonizing nature of trusting these senses, the sutra introduces an analogy that is, frankly, terrifying in its detail.
The analogy of the 84,000 sores.
The text asks the listener to visualize a sick person whose body erupts into 84,000 open sores.
And inside each of these open wounds are 84,000 swarms of tiny parasites.
The sutra notes that these creatures have sharp beaks and mouths, and they are utterly insatiable.
The visualization becomes even more intense as the sutra describes the behavior of these parasites.
If this terribly afflicted person attempts to find comfort by sitting near a heap of warm embers, the heat does not soothe them.
Instead, the heat torments the creatures inside the sores, causing them to bite and eat the person's flesh even more frantically.
Shariputra himself remarks to the Buddha that merely hearing this description makes his hair stand on end.
He notes that these creatures would give the host no peace whatsoever, causing the body to itch and burn continuously.
This horrific imagery serves as a direct psychological metaphor for the listener's own mind.
The itch is the internal experience of craving for sense pleasures.
When we feel that profound itch of desire, our instinct is to move toward the heat.
To indulge the craving, thinking it will bring relief.
But the sutra argues that indulging the desire is like sitting by the embers. It only agitates the underlying afflictions.
It feeds the parasites of our attachments, bringing no lasting peace, but rather a constant gnawing consumption of our spiritual and mental energy.
The relief of scratching an itch is tragically brief, and the damage done to the skin, or in this case, the mind, is lasting.
To completely sever the cycle of itching and scratching, the text introduces its most striking and culturally confronting analogy.
It is designed to shatter the very concept of desirability.
The suture describes a rotting, foul-smelling, dark, bluish-green corpse of a dog, completely infested with maggots, lying abandoned on the side of a road.
The Buddha asks Shariputra a rhetorical question. Would anyone of right mind praise a person who touches, shakes, or enjoys playing with that decaying corpse?
Shariputra naturally replies that such a person would be repulsive even to look at, let alone praise.
The Buddha then delivers an inversion that upends the ordinary value system.
He declares that the thus gone ones, the fully awakened Buddhas, would actually praise someone who plays with that maggot-filled dog corpse over a monk who, even with just a single toe, touches a beautiful 16-year-old woman adorned with jewelry while harboring a mind of desire.
When you encounter a passage like this, it is helpful to look at it through the lens of modern psychological interventions.
Like cognitive behavioral therapy or intense aversion therapy.
Exactly. The monastic mind is desperately craving a soft, romanticized, idealized form. The conditioning is incredibly deep.
So to break that conditioning, the sutra forcibly overwrites the soft-focused romantic filter with the starkest, most biologically grotesque reality imaginable.
It is a shock tactic designed to violently snap the mind out of its trance.
In the lexicon of Buddhist practice, this is a highly specialized technology of renunciation.
Lust is viewed in early traditions as the absolute strongest fetter, the thickest rope binding a sentient being to samsara, the endless cycle of suffering.
A gentle suggestion to let go is often insufficient against the biological imperative of human sexuality.
The mind requires a counterforce of equal or greater intensity to break the bond.
Which leads us directly into a terrain that requires careful, measured navigation.
Yes, it does.
The extreme aversion therapy regarding the young woman brings us to the most challenging and undeniably controversial section of the text.
Its intense deprecatory focus on the female body.
The scholar Jose Cabazon, in his introduction to the translation, states plainly that this is one of the most misogynistic texts in the Buddhist canon.
As students of the Dharma and history, we must acknowledge the text exactly as it is presented.
The mandate here is not to contort the text to defend it from modern sensibilities, nor is it to issue a contemporary condemnation.
The task is to understand the mechanics of what this text was doing in its historical and institutional context, and how it functioned for the people who read it.
To understand that function, we have to look closely at the environment of early Mahayana asceticism. Why would a text that opens with the sublime, ungendered philosophy of emptiness suddenly pivot to an intense deprecation of women?
Scholars who specialize in early Mahayana literature, such as Jan Natier, Daniel Boucher, and Ulrich Pagel, have traced the sociology of these texts.
They highlight that a significant strand of the early Mahayana movement was driven by male monastics who were engaged in extraordinarily demanding forest asceticism.
For these men, whose entire spiritual framework relied on the absolute ideal of physical and mental renunciation, sexual desire was the ultimate, ever-present hazard.
The deprecation, then, was not an objective biological treatise, but a highly subjective utilitarian tool.
Precisely. It was an antidote engineered by male monastics for male monastics.
They viewed women not as objective equals in a social sphere, but subjectively, through the lens of their own monastic vows, as the primary catalysts for their own hazardous lust.
Consequently, textual traditions emerged that heavily emphasized the repulsiveness of the female body.
It was a direct utilitarian mechanism to induce nausea and suppress male desire, reflecting the institutional androcentrism of the era.
The specific method this sutra uses to achieve that deprecation is truly astonishing when viewed through the lens of ancient medical history.
It is. The text does not just rely on general statements of foulness. It constructs a highly detailed physiological architecture of parasites.
The sutra claims, quite specifically, that a woman's body harbors 25 more distinct groups of parasites than a man's body.
The detail provided in the text is forensic.
It names these parasitic groups and assigns them very specific anatomical functions, essentially using them to explain the biological differences between the sexes.
The descriptions read like an ancient biological horror text.
They really do.
The sutra mentions masses of parasites residing in the brain known as robbers, whose function is to eat the brains of women.
It describes parasites dwelling in the nose called mouth terminators, which it claims eat women's mustaches, providing a bizarre ancient explanation for the lack of female facial hair.
It mentions creatures called eaters that instinctively pierce the ears, and parasites called obstructors that consume food first and deposit their waste into the breasts.
Which the text uses to explain both breast size and the generation of milk.
The sutra goes even deeper into the mechanics of reproduction, mapping the womb as a battleground of parasites.
It describes creatures called mighty exterminators that hunt and eat other parasites called lickers.
The text posits that pregnancy itself is a byproduct of this internal war, occurring when the death of these specific parasites coincides with the physical union of the parents.
Inside the birth canal, the text lists hosts of parasites with names like great lips, wind expellers, and desire catchers.
The ultimate conclusion the Buddha draws for the monks from this labyrinth of ancient biology is that these unseen parasites cause the female body to be completely ablaze with afflictions.
To a modern reader, encountering this passage can feel like reading pure, targeted malice or unhinged fantasy.
But if we analyze the intellectual environment of ancient India, a different picture emerges.
This isn't just a random invention spun out of the imagination of a solitary Buddhist author.
No, this sutra is actively drawing upon and integrating the established mainstream Indian medical literature of its time.
The translation notes provided by the 84,000 Project are illuminating here.
They point out that the Atharvaveda, an ancient foundational text composed between 1200 and 1000 BCE, contains extensive, detailed descriptions of worms, or krimi, that invade and inhabit the human body.
The concept of the body as a porous vessel colonized by microscopic entities was the standard medical paradigm.
If we look at texts that are chronologically closer to the composition of this sutra, such as early Jain literature and the Kamakshatra, we find identical medical theories.
Jain texts taught that vaginal worms were crushed and killed during sexual intercourse, which is the primary reason Jainism viewed the sexual act as inherently violent and non-virtuous.
Similarly, the Kamashastra literature utilized these same theories of internal parasites to explain the physical itch and arousal of a woman's sexual desire.
The mechanics of the sutra become much clearer with this context.
The author is taking the widely accepted medical science of the day, this pervasive parasite theory.
And weaponizing it.
Exactly. Weaponizing it for the sake of monastic ascetic practice.
It is the application of contemporary science to soteriological goals. This aligns perfectly with foundational Buddhist meditation practices, most notably Buddhaghosa Visuddhimagga.
The Visuddhimagga famously details the contemplation of a corpse in 10 stages of putrefaction.
Buddhaghosa argues that a living, breathing body is biologically just as foul as a rotting corpse, but our perception of that foulness is masked by what he calls adventitious embellishments, clothing, perfumes, the temporary bloom of youth.
This sutra uses ancient medical theory to mentally peel back those embellishments, exposing the raw, unsettling biology beneath to cure the monk of his infatuation.
Navigating this as a modern practitioner or a student of history can induce a kind of spiritual whiplash.
You are holding the profound, liberating, genderless teachings on emptiness in one hand and ancient, culturally bound, misogynistic biology in the other.
It is a tension that demands a mature perspective.
It demonstrates that the Dharma has always been a living tradition.
It was always taught in a specific historical moment to specific individuals, utilizing the cultural vocabulary and the scientific understanding available to them at that precise time.
The ancient biological models of parasites are obsolete.
But the underlying philosophical mechanism, the realization that our agonizing desires are driven by a superficial attachment to an external form that masks a decaying, impermanent reality, remains a core, enduring insight.
That distinction between the timeless truth and the temporary cultural packaging leads us directly to the concluding movement of the text.
Knowing that this intense biological deconstruction was a targeted antidote, we must examine how the Buddha himself frames the ultimate purpose of this teaching at the very end of the sutra.
The conclusion presents a profound structural contradiction that reveals the Buddha's underlying intent.
Throughout the entire length of the text, the intense, almost relentless focus has been on male monastics developing aversion toward women.
Yet in the final passages, the Buddha explicitly commands Shariputra to teach this exact discourse over and over again to the four assemblies.
The four assemblies in Buddhism refer to the monks, the nuns, the laymen, and the laywomen.
The inclusion of nuns and laywomen in the mandate to study this text is deeply significant.
It implies that despite the heavily androcentric framing and the specific biological attacks on the female form, the ultimate realization of the sutra is universal.
The goal is for everyone, regardless of gender or ordination status, to realize that the human body is a temporary fabrication, and that sense pleasures lack any ultimate substance.
The pedagogical strategy of the sutra is explicitly revealed in its concluding verses.
The Buddha states clearly, "To practitioners of the Dharma, I did not teach these faults. It is to whomever indulges in desires that I explain these faults."
This verse is the key to unlocking the entire text. It is the classic definition of what Buddhist hermeneutics calls a teaching of provisional meaning.
Or Nyarlathotha in Sanskrit.
For the listener, understanding the difference between provisional and definitive teachings is essential.
A provisional teaching is a method heavily accepted to the specific spiritual capacities, deep-seated afflictions, and cultural mindset of a particular audience.
It is a therapeutic intervention, not a statement of absolute, definitive truth.
It is the famous Buddhist analogy of the raft. You use a specifically constructed raft to cross a dangerous, rushing river.
But once you have reached the opposite shore, you do not pick the raft up and carry it on your back. You leave it behind.
Exactly. Advanced practitioners, those who have directly internalized the ultimate teaching of emptiness presented in the opening of the sutra.
Those who perceive the birthlessness of phenomena in every moment.
Right. They do not require these visceral biological contemplations. They see through the illusion of beauty and form effortlessly.
But for the beginner, or the monk who is actively burning with affliction and indulging in fantasies, the gentle, abstract philosophy of emptiness is not enough to break the spell of biology.
They require shock therapy. They require the bitter, aggressive medicine.
And the sutra makes it clear that the stakes for failing to take this bitter medicine are catastrophic.
The text outlines the 10 misfortunes of lapsed discipline.
It warns that a monk who succumbs to the illusion of desire and breaks his vows faces a terrifying trajectory.
He will be consumed by regret. He will be tormented at the moment of death by the fear of falling into the hell of unrelenting torment.
He will feel entirely forsaken by the Buddhas, by the realized hearers, and by the gods, ultimately facing an agonizing rebirth in the lower realms.
The sheer terror of those outlined misfortunes explains the extreme intensity of the text.
The sutra is the aggressive chemotherapy prescribed to prevent that fatal lapse of discipline.
It highlights a tough, uncompromising form of compassion. The Buddha is operating as a master physician.
The medicine he prescribes is incredibly bitter. It is harsh, and it is deeply offensive to modern sensibilities regarding gender and biology.
But it is prescribed with total precision, because the disease it is treating, the burning, deeply rooted agony of human craving, is viewed as absolutely fatal to spiritual liberation.
A skilled physician will use whatever tools are necessary to pull the patient from the burning house.
As we draw this deep dive to a close, let us look back at the immense landscape we have traversed through the sections of Dharma.
We began our journey in the high, clear, rarefied air of ultimate reality.
We explored the Mahayana view that all phenomena are unborn and fundamentally empty.
We examined how the simple, unexamined act of conceptualizing the five aggregates traps the mind in a state of painful bondage.
From that high philosophical peak, we descended into the visceral bodily reality of that bondage.
We analyzed the agonizing physical grip of unfulfilled desire through the striking analogy of the Pataka's, witnessing the mind boiling with its own afflictions.
We then confronted the intense, historically grounded monastic meditations designed to literally dissect and dismantle the illusion of physical beauty, sensory craving, and the human form.
We navigated the culturally bound, gendered methods early ascetics utilized to sever their deepest attachments, aided by the medical theories of their era.
And finally, we saw how the Buddha contextualized all this intense imagery as a provisional raft, a harsh but necessary medicine meant for a desperate illness.
Bringing the weight of this text back to your own life and practice, the fundamental mechanism of this sutra remains urgently relevant.
We may no longer rely on ancient Ayurvedic theories of parasites to explain our biology, but the architecture of our suffering is identical.
When you find yourself caught in the agonizing, tension-filled grip of wanting something, whether it is a relationship, a social status, or an aesthetic ideal, you must learn to forcefully deconstruct the object of your desire.
You must train the mind to look behind the bubble of water and recognize the empty, fabricated nature of what you crave.
We walked into an ancient spiritual clinic today, and we were handed a deeply challenging, complex cure.
The Buddha tailored an extreme, uncompromising antidote for the extreme life-or-death attachments of his specific historical audience.
The medicine was exact for the illness of that time and place.
As we leave this space, we leave you with a final reflection to mull over in the days ahead.
As you navigate the complexities of your own life, consider, what are the deeply ingrained illusions you cling to most tightly today?
What are the modern fantasies, the curated digital lives, or the material desires that make your own mind boil with affliction?
And knowing the depth of your own attachments, what kind of modern provisional antidote, no matter how bitter it might taste, would it actually take to shatter your own trance?
Thank you for sharing the sacred space with us.
Thank you for your patience, your open mind, and your ongoing dedication to studying the Dharma in all its complexity.
Until next time, may your practice be fruitful and your mind at peace.